Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is March 22nd. I am joined by two people who need absolutely no introduction here. One is Corey Lynn of Corey Diggs and her amazing researcher, The Sharp Edge. We are on audio only because these two people do such amazing research and deep dives. They are better off with their picture off the internet, and we support them fully. Corey, of course, did the wonderful book with us on vaccine passports and then did a whole series of series on the growth of sovereign immunity in international organizations. And last year with James White did the solution series, which if you haven't checked out, you have to. And if you're not signed up for Corey Diggs, Corey's website, it's a must have. And as Polly Tommy says, oh, when can we get Corey back? Anyway, so I wanted to explain this again because I'm not sure if Edge has heard this yet, but you know, I've been working with the state legislators to help them understand the risks that are coming and the total control grid that's coming, including through the financial system. And one of the things I keep seeing is there are a lot of wonderful gold bugs and people who believe in sound money who are encouraging them to do gold systems, and which I think are wonderful. But, you know, 5% maybe of the citizens have gold, 95%, 100% have dollars, and they need the state and they need a way to transact with dollars and not be controlled from Washington and Wall Street or have their transaction. You know, I mean, we can always do everything by Pony Express, but I'm not sure that's the best idea. You know, we have cash, we have checks. Checks are an open system, but you really want to have digital systems that have integrity and so that your sovereignty can't be compromised or controlled. And one of the things that happened, Corey, is that a company from London or from England showed up with a liquid. You can buy gold and then you can transact using MasterCard. And nobody saw the risk in that. And I said, wait a minute. This is not a solution because, you know, we can be controlled by the MasterCard system and the central banks have a ton of gold and we don't have a lot of gold. This looks to me like a very dangerous. You know, if it was one of many options, fine. But if you get dependent on this thing, so I need to make sure people understand, you know, that this control grid is very, very deeply involved with a credit card. And you and I, of course, have been talking off and on for years about the terms and conditions at the credit card companies to get worse and worse and worse and the amount of control that's coming in. Anyway, so I called you and said, would you be willing to do a deep dive on Visa and MasterCard? And you did. It was just published last week, and it's another blockbuster. So let me just turn this over to you. Let's start with, tell us about the Visa and MasterCard article and what you discovered.
Oh, wow. Well, I already knew that Visa and MasterCard were on the front lines of the digital ID control system because back when I was working on the book, I had my whiteboard out and I was narrowing down all of the big companies that I was seeing over and over again that were involved in this. And of course, Visa and MasterCard were right up there piloting programs. And I know Edge has also covered them in some of her articles. So we bullet pointed because it would have been way too long of a report. And we bullet pointed, we separated them out, Visa from MasterCard, because they're the two biggest ones, just to show how involved they are. And it's incredible. MasterCard has their own digital, what's it called, Edge? Digital identity.
They have a whole fully functioning, fully operational digital identity services division, and it's already active in two markets in Australia and Brazil.
And heading towards the U.S.
Yes, they have their eyes on the U.K. and the U.S. next. They're already approved to operate in the U.K., and they're working at the state level in the U.S., and that's a critical point.
Right. And they, so MasterCard has been in the lead on promoting the digital ID. And the president of MasterCard, the head of the company, just left and went to run the World Bank, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
The World Bank is running the fast payment system adoption, and he's promoting digital ID and governments owning the digital ID and controlling the digital ID at the World Bank.
Right. And Biden also had nominated MasterCard's chief legal officer and head of global public policy, Richard Verna. So he is the Secretary of State for Management and Resources. That was back in December 2022. They're heavily involved. Yeah, they just had the World Bank's global summit on March 5th, where what you're referencing, where AJ, how do you pronounce it, Catherine? Is it Banga? Banga? AJ?
No.
Well, at any rate, he is talking about how governments need to create digital identities for their citizens and that it's important that the governments own those identities. He actually says that in it, and we have a clip in the article. So, but Visa's, you know, equally involved in all of this. And the big concern that we wanted to lay out is whether or not the digital ID control system could be carried out without implementing CBDCs. And I fully believe on all of our research that they can. And based on what the Bank for International Settlements has said and the World Bank in their white papers, it certainly sounds plausible. And I see them almost as two separate sort of plans of attack. You know, we have the digital ID structure that they've been building out in numerous ways with biometrics and fingerprints and mobile apps and the driver's license. Is it ID Me? Or I don't even remember what that one's called. But that is one whole basket. But then I see the whole flip in the financial system as another one. But at the same time, there's a merge there and there's a control mechanism. So in the credit card area, you have your control mechanism, whether or not CBDCs are implemented or not. I mean, that's how I'm seeing it.
Right. So you wrote an article about more and more of the banking data being able to identify what the expenditure is. And now we see the, I think it's called the MCC code, used to stop certain purchases. So somebody uses their credit card. I've tried to use my credit card, and if it's, you know, if it's a flagged or suspicious, you know, so if you're buying a gun, it won't work.
Right.
So we see lots of increasing social credit control systems being applied to both banking systems and credit card systems. And
right.
And so that's has been my concern, because I'm with you. I think they can implement this without CBDCs. I do think they need the digital ID, and but I think they can do it without CBDCs, and we can't let ourselves be lulled into thinking they need CBDCs to do it, because,
right,
yeah. So that's why I keep talking about financial transaction freedom, because we need financial it's not enough to just stop CBDCs. You can stop CBDCs and not stop the financial transaction control.
Right, right. The digital ID is the key to it. And so we actually, Edge and I, yesterday were going over it in our podcast on an article I had found where a woman broke down the top countries that had implemented digital identities to some degree. And she was talking about, you know, the privacy and whether it was voluntary or mandatory. But the one common thread between all of them is that in order to access government services of any kind, you had to have the digital ID. So even in countries where maybe it's still voluntary, you can't access government services. And then in other cases, of course, it's linked directly. You can't set up a bank account or you don't have access to healthcare, which I think the very next step in this is while they're continuing to roll this out with the digital IDs, is that they're going to then try and lock it in with universal health care and then universal basic income. I think those are kind of the next steps.
So I've been working, you know, this year with state legislators or with people working with state legislators. And one of the things I'm seeing is there is still not a clear picture of the what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a person who's lived with the blessings of relative freedom or liberty your whole life, you just don't see this control grid coming.
Right.
And so the first job of anybody dealing with their state legislators and state representatives is to help them understand this is a serious problem and it is their responsibility to deal with it. Those are the first two steps that you need, because unless they see the problem and are willing to take responsibility for it, you can't get anything done.
Right. Well, and as Edge pointed out in the report, you mentioned, Edge, how the fact that, you know, by utilizing credit cards to hook into these, you know, create these digital ID systems, that people are so used to using credit cards now that they almost trust them, as opposed to not trusting the government. So with them rolling out through, you know, credit card companies, I think they have a much better shot at pulling this off. And then on top of that, we see with massive inflation and people really struggling after the pandemic and the, you know, manufactured crashes here, the use of credit cards, they're shown in the fourth quarter of 2023 that it increased by $50 billion to a record high of $1.13 trillion. And that there's also a major rise in delinquencies, as well as small businesses carrying balances over. So,
yes.
So you look at, you know, how they're, and then I have people emailing me going, well, what are we supposed to do if, you know, we're strapped right now, we can't even afford to get our weekly groceries for the family, and we're having to use our credit card. What are they supposed to do to get off the credit cards? So it's really kind of an awful complex web.
Right.
Corey, I want to add to what you said and just give some of these details from our report. So the senior VP of the Digital Identity Division over at MasterCard has come out and said that they understand very well that there are definitely some countries where the idea or the concept of a government-issued digital identity would not be broadly accepted. And they consider, MasterCard considers themselves to be well-positioned then in sort of a public-private partnership capacity to help in that acceleration of public acceptance because of their brand, because of the trust behind that brand. And they already have the network in place. So they have absolutely positioned themselves to facilitate broad acceptance of the digital IDs because they understand full well that the public would reject the idea of a government-issued digital ID.
Right. If you look at the polling on these questions on both CBDC and digital ID, the public wants nothing to do with any of this. I've been surprised at what the rejection numbers are where you get people to focus. And so it doesn't surprise me that they would try and use the credit card companies this way because they've been around so long.
Right.
And it wasn't until very recently that they started to mess, you know, to sort of mess with your, you know, it, there, whatever evil we've seen come through them is pretty subtle. I've had a couple of experiences now that are pretty sneaky, but you know, other than that, they've been pretty good. Now, one of the things I heard, you guys did a wonderful podcast on this topic for Corey Diggs, and one of the things you talked about is how a lot of this really kicked up in 2019, which I thought was interesting because 2019 was when the Federal Reserve and the G7 central bankers voted on the going direct reset. And so I thought it was interesting that 2019 saw a kick up in contributions from the credit card companies for the control grid.
Yeah. Did you want to speak to that, Edge? I know you were talking about there was one key moment of kickoff there in 2019. I'm trying to recall here.
Yeah, Visa really accelerated this idea of B2B Connect. So Visa's B2B Connect network was designed in 2019 to offer digital identity solutions and a centralized system of record for each and every payment. So this really accelerated in 2019. And Catherine, I do not think it's a coincidence. Right. The timing on that, it seems that they were well aware of what was coming and this going direct reset.
Well, and then March 2019 is when MasterCard introduced their new framework for the evolution of digital identities. So, well, and then also just recently in February 19th, 2024, you had mentioned this to me, Catherine, that Capital One, a major issuer of both Visa and MasterCard, announced it would acquire Discover in an all-stock deal worth $35.3 billion. So if that goes through, it would make it, you know, the largest card issuer if measuring outstanding card loans.
Right. It's more proof that there's no such thing as antitrust law anymore.
Right.
Because these guys really are a duopoly. It's like Burger King and McDonald's, Visa and MasterCard. Now, talk a little bit about the Gavi Alliance, because one of the things that made me most nervous about MasterCard was what they were doing with Bill Gates and the Gavi Alliance.
Yeah. So in December 2018, MasterCard partnered with Gavi, and that was for the purpose of, and this is in their words, efficiently delivering vaccines to millions of children, tracking identity and immunization records in a digitized manner, and incentivizing the delivery of vaccines. So they created the MasterCard Wellness Pass chip card that in various countries, and it utilizes tokenized biometrics to adhere to vaccination cycles. And that launched in December 2021. So MasterCard All In was $50 million in commitments to assist in the deployment of the jabs, as well as the their wellness pass projects with Gavi.
So I think it was you who sent me the video of Thale, the defense contractor, talking about this. You know, they had sort of a social credit information system where their app and the system is helping you get through the day, and we're reminding you about your mandated vaccination. And of course, the implication is if you don't take your mandated vaccination, you're going to be cut off from the whole system and your ID and your money.
Right. Right. We've been warning about that for years.
Right.
Yeah, because they you know, they don't hide it. They clearly state, oh, won't it be wonderful? I mean, even in the clip that we have from AJ, from, you know, the World Bank president, just from a couple weeks ago, where they're talking about how, oh, then it'll be right. Once we have that, then we'll be able to just tie it, just hook you right into a bank account, health, and travel, as though like they're doing you some wonderful benefit by getting you on this government-owned ID.
I don't know if you saw this. David Knight, we'll probably play it next week on or 2 weeks from now on Money Markets. David Knight had this wonderful video from a tech conference where they're running one of these, you know, turbo chipper videos on the wonders of AI and how great it is and all the great things it's doing and open AI. And the crowd is just booing and booing and booing and booing. It's really funny.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, it's, yeah, David just ran it, and it's great. And everybody's just booing him, you know, and booing the hype and booing the, it's, you know, people are getting smarter.
Yeah.
I know you both have really tried to warn your audience. What have you found is the most effective in helping leaders of, you know, whether in a community or a state legislature realize, oh, we have a real problem?
Hmm. Corey, you want to take that one?
Well, I don't know if I can say what's been most effective. I think that tons of phone calls and making things go viral on social media has definitely raised awareness to where they feel like they have to kind of step in and do something because everybody's talking about it.
Right.
I would say, I remember watching a video with Frank Nicely, and I can't remember who was with him. I believe you were there, where he was saying, you know, we get all these terrible emails all the time. It would be nice to get some support once in a while. And so
yeah, that was the panel in Rogersville. That was Bud Halsey, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So we've been trying to tell people, listen, you got to encourage them. You got to work with them. You got to support them, but you got to be firm, you know, and be insistent, but don't attack them, because that's just not going to get you anywhere. So
we've kind of been working and attacking this issue in phases. The first phase was really focused on researching what this whole system is and exposing it and getting that information to the public. And now we're in the next phase where we're really focusing on taking action, because it's not enough to just know what you're up against. It's about how do we mobilize people and empower people? And so, because that's really the questions we would get. We would get, okay, great, we know all this information, but what do we do with it? How can I myself do something? And so that's what that Take Action report was all about, is putting all of the information, very simple, very easy to digest, short article with a lot of links, really used as a reference that you keep going back to, and also giving those ideas on what action steps to take personally and collectively, as far as notifying state representatives, hey, look, these bills did really well in this state. This is successful legislation. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can model new legislation in your state after these successes. And so we've just been focusing on getting the resources into the hands of the people so they can take action and feel empowered rather than helpless against this, you know, system that they're trying to put in place.
I've always been astonished, both when I worked in Washington, but also when I work at a state legislature, how few people it takes taking action and communicating and being ornery to really get a legislator galvanized to act. It's amazing. You know, people who really focus and communicate can absolutely get their state legislators to take action. It's quite...
You know what I think would be fantastic? If you, Catherine, after your experience, because I know you're kind of traveling around and meeting with different legislators, and I'm sure you're taking copious amounts of notes. If you were to put something together, eventually, once you see, you know, what's really going on in each place, that is short and sweet, maybe just a few pages, that could be a PDF file where individuals could take it and review it and say, okay, this is what you need to do. This is what you need to get into the hands of the legislators, because we're doing our best trying to compile. We're grabbing some stuff from you. We're finding some of our own stuff, and we're you know, but I think just like a kind of a step-by-step with here's the model legislation, here's this, here's what needs to be done, kind of short and sweet.
That is in fact what we're doing for the first quarter wrap up.
Cool.
So that will roll out in April and May, and we're going to take everything we've learned so far this, you know, on the Financial Transaction Freedom Tour and roll it up into basically a take action primer. And one of the things we lay out is, I just sent you the commentary, the greater taking. What are the important steps that states need to do? Mm-hmm. So we can give you a list of the steps states need to take, and we can give you links to sponsored bills or bills that have passed that address those things.
Right.
But the first step first is to identify who are the legislators who understand there's a problem and are willing to own the problem and take responsibility for it.
Right.
You know, that's where you have to start, because you need, you know, I hate to say this, you got an awful lot of people who are happy to make money, you know, helping Mr. Global get his way.
Right.
So when you walk into the legislature, you got a war between the guys who are helping Mr. Global and the guys who are trying to help the Freedom Team.
Right.
And it's, you know, it battles out one day, 1 hour, you know, one bill at a time. It's amazing to watch it. And one of the reasons I wanted you to do the Visa and MasterCard is you have these wonderful sound money people who are showing up at the state legislature and they're saying, oh, here's the solution. We'll just get on Bitcoin or we'll just get on gold and silver. And of course, that's not going to work. I mean, it's a wonderful thing for states to have a bullion depository and do gold and silver. And I'm a big proponent of that. But right now, the central bankers have a ton of gold and the residents of most American states, you know, maybe 3 to 5% have gold.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if they shut off our ability to transact bank deposits and cash and dollars, but we can use gold, then we got to go begging to them for gold. And of course, they're going to make us sell our land and real estate. It's going to be a land grab. That's exactly what happened during the Depression. So we absolutely want a way to transact our dollars. And so for me, the most important thing is the state bank or financial transaction integrity, because otherwise we're going to be back carrying our checks around on, you know, Pony Express.
Right. And when you say a state bank, will there be branches of the state bank as well?
No, because you don't want a bank that's going to be a retail bank. You've got what a state wants to do is have lots and lots of community banks and credit unions.
Okay.
And you don't want to compete with them and you don't want the government competing with them. You want to encourage as many private banks and credit unions as possible. And in fact, one of the roles of a state bank in the long run is going to be to help protect the banks from, you know, games from New York and Washington.
Right.
So, and because we're in real, the bankers are in real danger of serious consolidation coming out of Washington and Wall Street. So you want a state bank that is really there to protect the local banks and credit unions and is not there to compete with them for business. And I should say some states like Tennessee have constitutional provisions that stop them from owning the bank, but that doesn't stop the state banks from creating a state-focused depository, just like the banks in New York have created the New York Fed for the U.S. government. So, you know, you can have a state bank that does the state depository business that's owned privately or owned by citizens of the state, or both.
I'm curious. I'm wondering about, so I know that there's a few states, which happen to be blue, actually, that have legislation in place regarding cash. How cash has to be accepted, you know, at all places. I just wonder how that carries through. So say you own a business, your own business, and you only want to accept credit cards. You don't want to accept cash, which we've seen plenty of businesses out there that do that now. Is that legal? Can they actually create that legislation and insist that a business accept it?
I'm not sure. I don't see how they do that. I can see why, you know, Ray Flores has this wonderful lawsuit against the national parks saying that the U.S. government has to accept it, you know, and I would take the position that the U.S. government does have to accept cash, you know, so you can't keep somebody out of a national park because they don't have a credit card. The position of the legislatures in Tennessee has been, we're not going to force businesses, you know, private business is a private business.
Right.
We're not force them to take cash. What they tried to do this session, which I absolutely love, this is one of my favorite sort of bills to propose, and they weren't able to get it through. We'll see if we can do something again next year. Any cash transaction, any transaction at a private business paid for with $500 or less of cash is void of the sales tax. Isn't that juicy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the businesses don't have to collect sales tax on anything $500 below in cash. Now, the reason it didn't go through is it got hit by a very stiff revenue bill. And the revenue bill is what they sort of describe as the cost. And you've got to fit it into the appropriations in the budget. But I think even if we could lower it to $100.
Right.
And then get it through. That's, to me, that's a much better way to keep cash alive, which I think is absolutely critical.
Oh, yeah.
Because then you make it really attractive for the market and the businesses to do it. And I like making it attractive as opposed to making it punitive.
Right. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Catherine, I wanted to bring a bill that I looked at and linked in our report to your attention and get your thoughts on it, because it's related to this discussion on giving people in states the ability to transact that is connected to bullion depositories. So in Oklahoma, they proposed an act relating to the state treasurer, requiring the treasurer to develop a proposal for the implementation of certain debit card services based upon deposits within the Texas Bullion Depository. So within the Texas Bullion Depository, this act is in Oklahoma. So they're trying to tether some sort of debit card services with deposits in the Texas Bullion Depository. What do you think about that idea? Do you think it could be successful if we had states doing something similar?
So I'm one of those people who loves all the transaction liquidity. And so in theory, I think anytime you can bring transaction liquidity, it's good. The problem is if you set up a system that automatically links you into MasterCard. So many of the systems I've seen like this using gold are proposing, you know, they're proposing to use a British company that uses MasterCard.
Oh, boy.
Well, how fast do you think that could hook you into the control grid?
Right.
Okay, so if we, it would have to be some sort of debit card service that is not linked in any way to Visa, MasterCard, Discover, whatever.
I'm just about, if you look at the paper we did on bullion depositories, I'm working on a new paper on specifications for gold and silver liquidity and what you would need to do. Part of the problem is if you're using Oklahoma citizens, but you're using the Texas Bullion Depository, can you be free of federal statutes if it's interstate commerce? That's one question. So to me, the ideal way for the states to do gold and silver liquidity is to have their own bullion deposit. To me, every state should have a bullion depository that can provide not just depository services for gold and silver, precious metals, but depository services for digital assets as well. So I think a bullion depository is essential, and I think a state banking depository like a New York Fed or a state-owned one for a state is even more important. Now, let me go back and explain this again. When the Berlin Wall fell down and the Soviet Union collapsed, we saw a process begin all over the world. It happened in Eastern Europe. It happened in Latin America. It happened in some of, you know, in the urban areas in the United States. But it certainly happened in Russia. It was called the Rape of Russia, and it was well documented. It's very similar to what happened in the Great Depression, and that is you do something that induces a shock deflation. So in the Great Depression, you know, you shut down a whole bunch of banks, and a lot of depositors lost their money and their bank deposits. You know, and all of a sudden, they lose their dollars, they lose their bank assets, and what do they have left? They have their real estate and their land. So they have to sell that basically to feed the family, and you get a land grab. So the Depression was a huge consolidation of wealth, including a land grab. Now, I go back to any state in the United States right now. The citizens have dollars, and they have land, and maybe they have a business. But what they don't have is they don't have precious metals. Maybe they got a little bit. 3 to 5% have a little bit of precious metals. If you look at the state government has dollars, and, you know, in the pension funds and some of the reserve funds, they have securities, but they don't own precious metals. Okay. You know, you have tiny amounts that are the exception to the rule. The central banks in Washington have a ton of gold. So if we set up a system that requires gold and silver, and the citizens in the state don't have gold and silver, but the central banks in Washington do, guess who's going to be in complete control and who in a shock deflation can grab all the land?
Right.
Okay. This is why it's absolutely essential that within the state jurisdiction that citizens be able to transact with each other, with the banks, and with the states without Washington or the Wall Street stopping them or interfering, right? You need dollar transaction liquidity, and you need both analog and digital. And you need it under state jurisdiction, and you need the feds not be able to control or stop it.
What I'm finding is the biggest hang-up is the processing companies, the rails, and the gateways.
Right.
So they're all working with Visa, MasterCard, and all, you know, the big credit card companies. And so they're all tied in. They're requiring more verification processes. They're getting more personal information. They're cutting some people off if they're not, you know, carrying out the narrative they want. We're already seeing this happening. And so I keep looking back at banks going, why can't banks create their own independent gateway? But it gets very complicated because then you've got banks in other states, you know, if you're trying to transact with someone in another state. So I'm thinking, obviously, the smaller banks, the family owned, the, you know, community and credit unions. I feel like this almost has to come, yes, with legislation, but I feel like the smaller banks almost need to devise a plan for transaction purposes where they can get on their own gateways and processing services and get away from these major credit card companies.
Right. One of the things, this gets back to seeing the problem and owning it, taking responsibility. We have a template letter you can send to your banker that's about, okay, what are you going to do? Because just like we need the state legislators to take responsibility and own the problem, we need the bankers to take responsibility and own the problem.
Right. I think that these small banks, local banks, and credit unions need to see this as an existential threat to their existence and take it seriously. And if they formed coalitions and were petitioning to the state treasurers, look, if you want to protect, you know, these banks, these small banks and credit unions, we've got to create another system.
Right.
An alternative.
So one of the things I wrote, you know, I had a little elevator speech that I give to people who I'm introducing this issue to. And I took three, you know, we have this collection of short videos up at Solari, and I think we're up to over 100 now. But they're short videos to show the, you know, the challenges to financial transaction freedom. So we have the Augustine Carstens from 2020 saying we can control everything and enforce it. And then we have Bo Lee saying we can program your money. And then we have Neil Kashkari, the president of the Minneapolis Fed, saying, you know, why would Americans ever, I understand why the Chinese want this because they want total control, but why would Americans let this happen?
Yeah.
And the beauty of those three videos is it's not the Freedom Team telling you this. It's the central bankers telling you what they're going to do. They're telling you, and it's so bad what they're going to do that the president of one of the 12 Fed banks is telling you, don't do this. It's that bad.
Yeah.
There's no benefit. There's no benefit. We already have digital currency. We just, it's the centralized, you know, centralized is the key word there. You know, it's the centralized control. And so, like, why there's no benefit whatsoever to any of us. It's absolutely about the control grid.
Right. So we did last year, we published a big study by Elsa von Hamlin called Pharma Food. I know you looked at it, Kari.
Yeah, that was excellent. We actually had her on our podcast to talk about
it. I know. She's fabulous. And we, you know, as I was reading Pharma Food, one of the hardest things I've ever had to read, I thought, how in the world do they think they can get people to eat this stuff? You know, even mind control technology is not strong enough to get people to eat this stuff.
Right.
And I realized, oh, they're confident they're going to get the control grid, whether it's with MasterCard or Visa or fast payments or banking systems or CBDC. They think they're going to get the complete control grid. And, you know, they can basically say, okay, no pizza. You just get insect-based cricket flour.
Right. And even MasterCard in June 2021 launched an e-livestock digital ID for the cattle supply chain. So they're even trying to get in on that end of it as well. So it would be digital proof of provenance, which, you know, yeah, which we've seen that in the news recently as well. There are our government's trying hard to push the IDs, the tags, the RFID tags, I believe, on cattle.
And Corey, you put a great graphic in one of our reports that really outlines to people from the user to the trying to purchase a hamburger how that control grid will work. And it's not in our words, it's in, as you had described, Catherine, the central planner's words. Corey, do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, that's the graphic, Catherine, that I used in my book, because it's pretty much the only graphic I've found from states thus far that really illustrates to people where they start with their digital ID verification, and then they show, oh, here's, you know, a welfare applicant, and it goes over to through the government entitlement office, and then they go to the grocery store and they use their smart contracts, eligibility smart contracts, and the healthy eating incentive, and they have their benefit wallet, and when they go to purchase, oh, the cheeseburger is outside the cart because it's not allowed to be purchased. So this is just a great example of how just that single digital ID can hook into all these things. And they plan on doing this all through these smart contracts.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so funny because, you know, one of the videos we use is the Boleaf, the deputy director of the IMF, talking about how CBDC will allow inclusion. Well, I live in a town where maybe 3 to 5% of the people don't have bank accounts, and they go, you know, they go to the utility and pay their bill in cash, or they go to the post office and buy money orders and mail those. Mm-hmm. But the reason they don't want to have a bank account is privacy. They don't want the bankers knowing their business.
Right.
And they, you know, there's not an exclusion problem because, or there's no inclusion problem because they don't want to be included.
Right, right.
Which is more and more the way I feel. I don't want to be included in any of this anyway. So we just saw a great piece that Michael Nevidarkis did for The Defender. We had covered the story on Money and Markets, and then I was talking to some of the folks who work with The Defender, and they got them going on it. But you had Jay Powell say in testimony, so chairman of the Federal Reserve, 2 weeks ago, that the Fed is not remotely close to doing a CBDC. Hmm. Well, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth, because you have the Richmond Fed and the San Francisco Fed busy hiring people to implement CBDCs. And, you know, the Fed doing all sorts of stuff to make, whether it's CBDCs or financial transaction control, a reality. So the notion that they're not remotely close, you know, it's just really slippery talk. One of the things I've heard you both say is you think they have the capacity to go to complete control now.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was going to point out is in saying that they're not remotely close, I would disagree. The BIS Innovation Hub, you know, they've been very busy, and they set up the Nexus Gateway. So it's to connect all the fast payment systems across countries through a cross-border, you know, system through this gateway. And what they did is in 2023, they have a report where they said they will open the door to other alternative payments infrastructures such as CBDCs. So they ran, this was just in September last year, they successfully ran a test on cross-border wholesale CBDCs that was tested through BIS and the central banks of France, Singapore, and Switzerland. So they've got, they have the infrastructure, but they're saying, you know, we could use, we could have these kind of separate, and we could run the fast payment systems and contactless chips or QR codes and API interfaces. And then eventually we can just piggyback it on to the CBDCs. So I think they're a lot further along.
Yeah.
So I want to connect the dots to some other parts of the control grid. I just did an interview with Bob Yan Cox, who is the attorney in New York who's been litigating against the quarantine regulations. So for 7 years in New York, they tried to get the legislature to pass a bill saying they could basically quarantine whoever they wanted without due process, mm-hmm. and also confiscate real estate property to quarantine them. So so they couldn't get it through the legislature. So the health the health agency just issued regulations saying they could do this. And so Bobby is representing several legislators who are suing and saying, look, health agencies are not allowed to legislate law. We make law and they can't do this. Now, if you look at the law, it's completely on their side. They have the law and case law. She won in the first court and then they appealed and she lost 5-0. Now they're appealing it again, but I took one look at it when I first heard her describe what she was doing. And I said, Bobby, this has nothing to do with health. This is so they can control the media and the financial system in New York.
Yep.
They need to be able, you know, they don't need a group of hedge fund managers fighting them on this. When the time comes, they need to be able to go lock up whoever they want, whenever they want, with no due process and scare everybody else to death.
Right.
Now, the other thing, Meryl Nass has been doing a wonderful job of meeting with countries around the world, trying to talk them out of agreeing to the WHO treaty. Because in my opinion, once you get enough transaction control that you can come in and do your shock deflation and disaster capitalism, the WHO treaty is one of the most elegant place-based control and theft-taking machineries I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it gives you the ability to shut down a neighborhood, shut down the businesses, and by the time you're through that place, you'll own everything.
Right.
It's amazing. It's sort of like an invasion tool, an economic invasion tool. Anyway, she's been meeting with the countries and the countries say, you know, we know this is bad. We know we shouldn't agree to this, but we're in a debt trap and the bankers will shut us off if we don't go along.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So,
wow.
So this control is coming from different directions, including food control, as you and Edge have really written about as well. So,
Catherine, I wanted to add to the infrastructure, how we were discussing about how a lot of this infrastructure is already in place and ready to go. I wanted to highlight a couple of key points. Visa, they're really at the forefront of the token transformation, and they offer these diverse tokenization technologies to merchants, regional banks, banks, and central banks. And central banks is key because we know, as you know, the BIS, the central bank of the central banks, is keying into that of tokenizing all assets, all individuals, all information, and putting it on one global unified ledger. And I believe that Visa, you know, already has that infrastructure in place, already has those technologies in place, ready to go and available to central banks to do that. And CBDCs would be core to the functioning of it on the global unified ledger. It would serve as the reserve currency on the global unified ledger.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Edge. You know, one thing they may be doing is using, so Ripple, you brought up Ripple in your report too, but using private cryptos like Ripple and Visa and MasterCard to bootstrap enough control to the point where you can force CBDCs.
Yeah.
So
I can see that.
Yep. So, because I'm with you guys. I don't think they have to use CBDCs at all. They can do it.
Yep.
You know, they can get enough of these systems working together with AI and software, and you can go to complete control without it. But, you know, here's the sort of the sickening thing about this. This is not Mr. Global implementing this system. This is thousands, if not millions, of financial companies and technologists who are helping to do this. We are building our own prison. We are watching a group of humans building their own prison.
Yeah.
And it's shocking.
It is. And one of the things I'm wondering is, could a state bank set up I don't know. I feel like
could have said thanks, set up a card system without these guys.
Yes.
I think that's the question we need to ask and look into and pursue.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Because we want liquidity, but we're going to need telecommunication systems, payment systems, you know, debit and credit card systems that are not controlled. I mean, the Chinese set up their own credit card systems. The Russians have, right?
I mean, even if it was to start out as a debit card, just simply for transacting, because credit card, I mean, now you're getting into loans and everything else, but at least with the debit cards for transacting would be hugely beneficial. But again, then I don't know how that works going state to state or going to, let's say you need to send funds to someone, whether it's a business or an individual over in another state who's banking at Bank of America. You know, are you going to be able to transact in that manner? Because they, of course, are all dialed in with the bigger credit card companies.
Do you get, say, Texas, who has a well-established bullion depository, to create their own network of within, you know, some states that are willing to cooperate on this? The gold or bullion is deposited in the Texas depository. And this network is just similar to the Visa and MasterCard network, but just independent from it. And, you know, so these states can operate interstate. Could you do that?
Yeah, you could. I mean, again, the question is a legal jurisdiction. Does it put you under federal jurisdiction, which you're hoping to avoid?
Right.
I did talk to one great state legislator who pointed out that if you look at Texas and a lot of the southern states who are talking about different forms of cooperation in this manner. He said, you know, if you add us all up together, we really are the OPEC of North America. So, well, they've got so much oil and gas.
Right. Right. You know,
look down in the Gulf and Texas and down in the Gulf, they've got so much oil and gas. Okay. Well, our goal in 2024, we see amazing pushback all over the world. And when it comes to financial transaction freedom, there is major pushback in the United States. And it's very gratifying.
It is.
Occasionally, somebody will write me and say, why is no one doing anything? And I said, wow, pal, you are out of it. There are a ton of people doing it. And, you know, it's amazing some of the things that have been happening, because now you have, you know, you have the treasurers and the governors and the attorney general. You know, you're talking about real resources here.
Right.
Of people saying, wait a minute, you know, I'm not so willing to just throw the Constitution away. I will say this, our biggest challenge out at the states is there's, you know, state legislators pledge an oath of office to both the state constitution and the federal constitution, but then the feds come along and talk them into doing unconstitutional things by throwing money at them.
Right.
And the challenge, if you're a state legislator, is your constituents want the money.
Yeah.
So how are you going to build a bottom-up constituency for the rule of law, even when it means we have to tell the feds to go jump in a lake? Because, you know, we don't want money if it requires us to teach our children how to be sex slaves.
That's right.
I think a top priority for citizens right now, maybe not the number one, but one of the top priority is the debt.
Yes.
And nobody is addressing that. Congress is definitely not addressing that. And so I think that they're doing a great job of highlighting how, you know, this is an urgent issue by driving up the debt and making that top of mind for most citizens. And I think that those citizens are relaying that to their state reps. I think that the pressure is on for them to say no more spending on these wasteful projects, right? I mean, I think that there is that pressure there, more so than before.
Well, there are two things I really focus on when I look at the federal debt. The first is we could just have the Treasury issue greenbacks and there wouldn't be any debt.
Hmm.
We don't need a debt-based currency. A debt-based currency just puts us in a position where we lose our sovereignty because we're in debt. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is let's look at exactly how the cash flows work on that debt. So we put money into our pension funds, our IRAs, our retirement accounts, and then those accounts buy treasury bills and treasury bonds. And so the cash leaves our retirement accounts and it goes to the treasury. And then starting in fiscal 1998, the money leaves through the back door. So now we have $21 trillion of assets missing from the federal government. And those assets would be securing, you know, the bonds that were issued, right?
Yeah.
But they're not. It's disappeared out the back door. So the Treasury has become a money laundering operation to steal
money
out of our pension funds and retirement accounts. And then if you look at, well, what do we have in our pension fund? We have an IOU from ourselves as taxpayer. So if I bought a $1,000 bond, my $1,000 has disappeared out the back door, but I as a taxpayer now owe $1,000 to myself. And, you know, my home and assets are on the line to make good on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a very sobering reality.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I would like, we just put in a bill that is going to go to summer study in Tennessee, and I hope we get a chance to really do something in summer study with it. But basically, it proposed that the AG be authorized to create an escrow so that the residents of Tennessee could pay their federal taxes into the escrow, and the AG would represent them in terms of these issues before the federal government. Because if the federal government's not going to obey the financial management laws and spend money in ways that are outside the financial management laws and criminal,
right?
You know, then maybe it's time we make sure that the federal taxes are only spent for lawful purposes.
And you said someone is working on legislation for this?
Well, I put in a proposal.
Okay.
Which didn't go far, but it started the conversation. And you know, do you remember my common law right of offset story?
Oh goodness.
Okay. So this is in our taxation wrap up. The end of 2006, we settled the litigation. I got a big, you know, cash settlement. The government had to pay me back the money they owed my company. I finally won. I got the money. And at the time I sat down to pay off all the creditors. And I had had a credit card when the litigation started. I had had a credit card with Citibank. It was through the litigation I decided to pull out of all the big banks, but this was before when I still had an account. And I owed them $14,000 on the credit card. But at the time, I had the missing money in the country up to $14,000 per person in terms of citizens. Now it's $65,000. So $21 trillion was missing in 2015. We know there's more, but we can't get a good number from the way the government documents work and the way they've changed the administrative policies on keeping things secret. But at that time, the number was $14 trillion. So I wrote Citibank a letter and I said, I owe you $14,000 on this credit card, but you owe me $14,000 as an owner of the New York Fed and agent bank for the New York Fed, and you've been engaged in illegal transactions, you know, equivalent to $14,000 per person. And so I'm asserting a common law right of offset. I owe you $14,000, but you owe me $14,000. And if you've got a problem with that, here's the name and number of my attorney. Feel free to call and we'll negotiate or litigate. And they wrote off the debt and I never heard another word.
Nice.
Wow.
That's awesome. So, I love stories like that.
So I did assert a common law right, because here's the thing. The New York Fed has been engaged in massive criminal transactions using the taxpayers' money.
Right.
Massive.
Mm-hmm.
Completely outside the law. And that's why whatever we do, you know, individually or within our state, we need to be independent of that network.
Right.
Because if you had stolen that much money, I dare say you would want complete control of us as well. Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay, well, this has been terrific. I can't thank you both enough. I'm always doing this, Corey. I called you and said, could you do an article on Visa and MasterCard? And you're like, oh my God, do you have any idea how busy I am? I said, but I need vaccine passports, and you guys do the best research in the world. And you really do. What the two of you have accomplished in the last 3 to 4 years is just unbelievable. You've made an amazing when we stop this financial transaction control grid, your contribution will have been absolutely mighty. So
well, right back at you.
Yeah.
Right. I was going to say the same for you, much more for you. Yes, Catherine. Thank you so much.
Well, this is Operation Pushback 2024. We are not going to let this happen. So Edge and Corey, I just wish you all the best. Tell us a little bit about what's up next and tell us again about how to find your website and what we can find there, Corey.
Okay, so it's Corey's Digs, CoreysDigs.com. And Edge and I it used to be every Friday. We've moved to every other Friday. We put out a podcast just going over some of our reports or keeping people up to date on the important stuff they need to be aware of, not the distractions, because there's a million of those.
Right.
And right now I'm actually working on an article right now that's kind of outside the realm of all of the reports I've ever done. So that's kind of, you know, I also have a lot of resources on my site too. So people researching, I have a file drawer and 4 diggers, with lots of resources there. So yeah. Anything else, Edge? Am I missing anything?
I don't think so.
The solution series is there both on Corey's Digs and up at Solari. And it's just a great resource to get you taking action. So,
yeah, we did 24, James White and I, we did 24 great episodes on there. So that's still available. That's the only section on my site that's subscriber only, actually.
Okay. Okay. Well, Edge and Corey, thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. Ladies and gentlemen, look at the amazing lists. We'll post links in the commentary. Look at these amazing resources and decide what are the actions you want to take. But at a minimum, please reach out to the bankers in your life and reach out to your state representatives and tell them to start owning the problem. Because this is something that doesn't have to go down, and we can do something about it. So, and this is the year to do it. So, take action and have a great week. We'll be back with you next week. Bye.